session number 27226, Reel 14.
Reel 14.
Right. So, really, apart from that, as a result of all these activities, I was spent some time with the Airlies in Scotland on sick leave because they thought I'd need a rest. I was having a bit of a hard time, actually. And they thought I was stressed, and I probably was. But I was flying a lot. I mean, I was flying, you see, every day for two to three hours every day.
So what would your daily routine be like then, at that stage? You know, with your flying time, what else would you be doing in the day?
Well, I was only really... I had no job with the squadron at all. I know that some people looked after the wireless, but I didn't. I was teaching, of course. I was teaching NAV, of course. I was instructing the observers in the school in between times and flying. So when I was flying about 4 hours a day, which, you see, the 17th I flew 4 hours and 5 minutes there. On the 18th and 19th, I was flying two and three hours at a stretch each day. And then instructing navigation. Really, just life went by. You know, you flew and you did the jobs that we're doing. But we know actual squadron jobs we're talking about. I didn't have anyway.
What was your social life like then? What was your social life like?
Very good. Oh, yes. We had girlfriends in town. There's a family there, the Miles sisters, two sisters. The eldest sister, that I was quite friendly with, her boyfriend, her fiancé actually, was out in Ceylon when the Japanese came along and he was killed. And so she was a little bit stressed, and she had a sister as well. And we also spent a lot of time there, but we used to go to dances, Kirimu. Well, Kirimu is different, that's... the social life wrapped round going ashore into our berth, really, and we all had a good social life. There was pubs to go to and this sort of thing. But remember that most nights we're either flying or watching over flying and this sort of thing. It was a full existence, really, and I like flying, so I did a lot of trips for other people. Purely and simply, somebody wanted to go ashore, I said, well, I'll do a trip, and that was it, because I was not committed anyway. And so we're going really on a routine with a reasonably relaxed life. Food was good, we ate reasonably well.
What about the food then? Because obviously food for civilians is on ration. As aircrew, did you have access to other types of food?
Oh, we were well fed, no question at all. We had never had any problems there. I don't remember seeing that as a problem when we're at the when we're flying. No, it resolved itself into flying, going ashore. Generally going around, though there's an interlude there which I have to mention, because as a result of all this flying, what I was doing, I was doing more flying than most, and the net result was that they decided to send me off for a fortnight's rest and rehabilitation at Corkey in Scotland, which are the Airlie family, who are the Angus Ogilvy is the heir, is the Ogilvy family. And young Angus Ogilvy was there at the same time as I was when he was at home from Eton. And I lived in the house in those circumstances, very luxuriously, with the family. I knew the Airlies quite well. And I went to see them quite a lot after the war, too. But it wasn't hospitalisation, it was just there. with nobody else. I think there was one other person in a great big house, but well looked after. I don't know where we went to eat, but obviously we were fed and watered. And it was a good sojourn. I must have been there for at least 10 days. Let's have a quick look.
Was that sort of a period of rest then, really, from the amount of that you
Yes, I think. I think because I'd had so much stress early on with all this landing and you know, flying the Sawfish for the first time. I think it was getting a little bit much. I had the aircraft that we had on deck landing were not well maintained. We were always breaking the legs of them and that sort of thing. In fact, I got an endorsement.
How did your time at Arbroath come to an end then?
I got an appointment to go to Errol, which was the fix of my life. I went to convert back from Swordfish to Masters, which are monoplanes, to go down to Yeovilton. So Errol was just down the road. An airfield had just been started as an AFU, advanced flying unit, as a transition for people who found themselves filling in time because there were no carriers, nowhere to go, no activities worth talking about, you know, took a lot of people. It was a holding period for a lot of people there. And I went from there to AF on an appointment. Now, it's interesting in this concept in my personal life because I'd gone home from leave in June, I think, July it was. I'd gone home on leave and met my wife and got engaged. And she came up to stay with me in Errol, in a bit in Button Ben, just for a couple of days. And she was a great friend of the girl. There were two friends from Arbroath. She knew them, and they were going to stay there, but I'd been moved in the meantime. So she came and got those people had got to find a Button Ben, and she was staying in this place, which is a lovely story if I can tell you, if you want to hear it. We moved to Errol, which was a scratch airfield when it was in its embryonic state, just for transferring back to monoplanes. I fixed it up for Dorothy to go and stay in this little house, a little place, which was given to people after the First World War, a settlement for Scots, which was a cottage and a piece of land. And it consisted of one up and one down. And the man himself at that time was living downstairs in the lower room in a bed in the wall with his wife. And they made this place upstairs for Dorothy to stay, and they set out a meal for us and everything. So very kind, but I couldn't understand the word they said because they spoke pure Gaelic. Well, as a randy little sod then in those days, of course, and I went to see her and decided to stay as do what I could, but got no forward. Set off home, or back to the airfield, on a bike. I had a bike there. And I thought, you know, missing my chances here. And I drove along, and I had an acetylene lamp for the bike. And it went in perfect darkness, you know, nothing at all. And I ran out of acetylene. Well, that lamp stopped. And we're talking not about doing rough tracks by the side of fields. And so I thought, I'll go back and see if I can have a little word with Dorothy to stay the night. And so I went back to the place. And this place had a little archway over the door, a big wooden door at the bottom, with a water barrel behind it. And the window of her bedroom, which had been set out for her with food and everything else, on the top. So I got onto the top of this water barrel, climbed on the roof, and it's dark, banged on the window to try and get her attention. She didn't know who it was, of course. She let a scream. I thought, escaped. I slipped off the roof into the water barrel, soaking bloody wet. got out of the barrel and the light had gone on in the little room down below. So I had a peek through this keyhole, a bloody great keyhole in the door, to see this Scotsman getting out of bed in a bloody great big white shirt, reaching for a gun off the wall. Oh, Jesus. I thought, this is no place for me. So I got on the bike as quickly as I could and skidded up down the road, and he took a shot at me. He missed. And this reminded me, well, you read the story if you read the book, but the next day he regaled me with this story about how the Irish labourers who were working in the airfield tried to break in, and I had to hear this story, you know, in Gaelic or cross Gaelic, and keep my mouth shut, and I told Dorothy who it was afterwards. That was quite a little interesting episode, but that was flying. Again, and that was flying for me in a new environment, converting back to an inline aircraft, no longer radials. Bear in mind, I've been flying radials or the Tiger Moth, which is virtually a radio, all the time.
With the conversion back, was this at this point, was it decided that you were going to go for fighters? Or had
I'd been decided then, I was decided to be a fighter boy when I was in Canada, but I was tonsillitis. I missed my course at Yeovilton. All the other lads went on to that one, and they had a hard time. But I got sidetracked and went up to Scotland for, 4 or 5 months, which saved my life, probably, when I think about it.
So what was this environment that Arrol was like? What was so different about this environment?
It was just a straight translation from Swordfish back to advanced flying, to the standard of Hurricanes at Yeovilton, and whatever fighter aircraft we had. So it was local flying, spinning of monoplanes, going through the whole gamut of exercise again that we went with the Harvard. But the transition was easy. There was no problem there.
And what was the master like as an aircraft to train on?
Very good. No question at all. But it had problems. Sometimes engines stopped, as it did with me one day, with my instructor in the back. Oh, this was when Dorothy was... This is when Dorothy was in the... had just arrived in this Button Ben, and she didn't know what I was flying or anything like that. And she came to the place and saw somebody flying around, and they dropped out of the sky. And I was doing aerobatics. It was me. And the engine stopped. And we were... This is an interesting story because it deals with other aspects of flying particularly. I'm doing aerobatics, and doing aerobatics, if you do slow rolls or negatively upside down, all the ullage from the bottom of an aircraft comes and covers you up. And we'd just been issued with a new set of goggles, not the floppy goggles we had, but with a steel bar across the top with angles at the side for going down to our berth, and we were flying in a master that had been fitting up with a gun sight, which had two steel bolts on the above the instrument panel where the gun sight had been, and taking the gun sight off. No problem, really, except we're upside down, nothing on the clock, the fan stopped. Look for an airfield. Find a field to do a forced landing with no engine at all. And we're making our approach to the airfield, and the instructor in the back said, I've got it. You know, he was going to take over. And so I thought, well, if he's taking over, I don't want to touch anything. So I took my feet off the pedals so that I wasn't interfering with it at all. Sat back. And he missed it. He went through the hedge in a nose-up attitude in the hedge and went straight forward and landed on the ground, bang. Now, the Maggie has got two cool radiators underneath the aircraft. And when he went forward, those two radiators came through the front cockpit where I was, right under with the pedals, and on up to the dashboard, completely crushed it completely. If my feet had gone on the pedals, I wouldn't have had feet. And I went forward on my straps, my knee broke off a half inch piece of mild steel, which is a control column for the flaps of the thing, and I went forward and I was wearing my goggles down, which I never did, like that, with a bar across the top, and I went forward and hit those two spikes with a metal piece of that thing, marked the scar, they were dented, and got away with it. I kept those goggles for years. I don't know what happened to them afterwards, but that was indicative of the sort of things that happened that time. And when I was we had to call the ambulance and everything else, they took me back, but of course I knew Dorothy was there, but she didn't know where I was or what I was doing, and I was going to this cottage. So I was taken back to the airfield, and the doc looked at me, and you know, after an accident like that, you know, you're not supposed to go, and say, for goodness sake, he said, my girlfriend just come over, she's staying at a button bend down the road, I've got a bike, I'll manage, you know. And he looked at my knee and said, oh, it'll be all right, then he'll let you go. So that was how I got to the cottage in the end, and the previous story was a corollary of that, really. But I was limping a bit, I was a bit hairy, but it was worth it to see the old girl again. So that was a girl I met. It's another story, if you want stories, that I went home on leave from in June for my next-door neighbour's wedding, who I hated. She was a bit like a horse, so she was a horrible woman, terrible. But they were telling me, when I went home on leave, they were telling me about this beautiful girl from West Hartlepool. And I was doing a fairly smart number with one regular that I'd known since she was 15 in Rotherham. And she was going to come over for this wedding, but she took a rain check and decided not to come. And if she had come, I would have been engaged to her. Maybe, we don't know. And so I'm at home, waiting for the wedding next day. And they told me this story about this rather beautiful girl that was living in West Hartlepool. And to me, anybody in West Hartlepool had four glasses and they're covered in coal dust and, you know, was horrible and spoke ridiculous. And at 1:45, and this is again a corollary of this story, at 1:45, a woman knocked on the door, and that was Dorothy, my wife to be. And she said, she was Dorothy, and you're Lionel, yes. And she was the best thing, says sliced bread. She was better than the one that I'd cast off. I was engaged to this before she went home, and I married her, and I married on my birthday, which is about 4 months later. And I'll show you a photograph of her in a minute. But that's the one, yes, but there's a better one there as well. That's one in the book. You see the one in the book? No, it's one in the book. Anyway, she went out for a meal, and I was engaged to her, and I married 4 months later. I was married for 6 weeks and went abroad for 2 years and 7 months.
How did she feel about witnessing your...
Well, she didn't know what it was. I told her later on, I said, that was probably me, because of that the engine stopped. She said she heard it stop and everything else. She didn't know it was me at all. But she never worried about my flying all the time. She probably did, but...
With those masters, you said there was problems with the engine stopping. Was there a reason for that?
I don't know. A very reliable engine, actually. That was just one off. But I had a nasty. One of the troops actually cross-wired my control column. So when I was taking off, if I wanted to go to the right, I wanted to go to the left, I'd go that way. And if I went over the left, it went over that way. In fact, I wanted to the right. And it went that way.
So everything was in the opposite
reverse, wrong way round.
Was that must have been quite difficult.
Well, it wasn't really, because I was already off the ground. I was just starting to take off, and I moved and moved, trying to straighten up or something like that, or pull it back. It went that way, went straight into the ground. I was having a hard time, I'll tell you.
What happened? Did that you crashed into the ground with that?
We crashed the ground, broke the air off, knocked the wing off and everything else.
But were you injured in that at all? Were you injured at all?
No, just a bump.
After these things happening, was there any form of investigation that took place?
Not really. They asked a question, but that was down to the instructor, because he's in... that one was down to the instructor. No, sorry. That was down to the troops. And the squadron, the engineer, that was his problem, not mine. We explained it to him. I don't know that we had a lot of interviews about it at all. It was just... I'm sorry about this coughing, but I've had a sore throat since yesterday, and it's talking is doing no good at all, but never mind. No, there was no real problem about it. It was just one of those things that sort of seemed to crop up. Incidental flying, there was, you know, so many of them. And once I got away from that situation, once I got down to flying proper, for want of to Yeovilton, I never had any more problems at all.
Do you know when you would go out in the, you know, before a flight, would you do pre-flight checks on an aircraft? And what would they, if you did, what would that
yes.
entail?
And we probably did the pre-flight check and just wiggled the things and saw it go down and never realised that when it was going to the left, it was down going the wrong way round, of course.
But what pre-flight checks would you do normally on an aircraft? What would you...
Oh, well, no. If, before you went in the aircraft, normally you'd sign the engine tip that the aircraft is okay. But you'd look around. You had a standard prognosis, you know, standard, what do you call them, PP, undercarriage, mixture, pitch, flax, fuel, dual gyro, for checking all the instrument bits. You would automatically wiggle your wings and see that everything was connected more than anything else. And do that, you know, do more or less an exercise. But when there was so much an exercise that the fact that the flop went down rather than going up, when you did that, you wouldn't notice, you know. That was quite interesting, was Errol, really. It's also interesting because later on in life, we were involved, of course, with the Kenya crowd, which was Lord Errol, in his own backyard, really. So there's a connection there. But AFU was really just basic flying, getting aerobatics, local flying, general familiarity in, you know, different fighting conditions to transfer to what we're trying for with Harvards, not to Hurricanes, sorry, which I had at Yeovilton.
Were you posted to Yeovilton after? Were you posted to Yeovilton after Errol then?
Yeah. I just to see how long we did here. I did this just through August. See, we came back to England, and normally we'd have gone straight there in January to Yeovilton. It's now end of August, and we're still not at Yeovilton. So I lost 9 months of my life. I'm pleased to say. But I spent all this time, all of August, flying three times a day in Master 1s, one after the other. And then that was passed out, and they went straight from there to join 760 Squadron at Heron at Yeovilton, which is, well, I went there on the 1st of September after having finished flying at on the 28th of that... Errol.
And how did you feel then about getting to Yeovilton? You must have been quite relieved after
quite
all that.
Quite pleased, yes. It's the best thing that ever happened, really. We got, I got where we wanted to be, but it took 9 months.
So can you take me through what happened as you arrived at Yeovilton?
The answer to that is yes. I went straight in, flying the next day on Hurricanes by myself. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. From then on, I flew without an instructor. I had a Master 1 for a test on an XMI 9, I don't know what it was. But I was flying Hurricanes all the way through until October, when I went to 761 Squadron for deck landings and fighter exercises, special flying, specific to combat experience, that sort of rubbish.
So when you went there, were you were actually with a squadron, were you? You were with a squadron when you arrived at Yorvalton?
We're always in squadrons. We're always put into a squadron.
Did the squadrons have different roles then? With some
yes.
training, some...
761 was ab initio for fighter aircraft, standard fighter aircraft, of familiarisation with the flying aspect of it. The secondary part was the practical applications of fighting, really, with also deck landing aspects too. We did a lot of addles, I think, at gunnery, attacks, formation flying in the second part at Holden. In Fulmers, and that went on until again November, right through to the 11th of November. Obviously went home on leave and were waiting for appointments, I suppose. Where did I go from there? No, yes, I went home on the 27th. I did some flying with the RAF at Driffield because I knew some people there, had a flip. But then I waited the 28th of November. That was the end of my service training at Yeovilton, which is a routine thing, flying quarter attacks and doing the little bits and pieces that you can detail if you want to, but you'd probably get it from other people, I'm sure. And then after that, I left on HMS Cilicia to go to 777 Squadron in Freetown.